you know, you and Boise.
Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Eleanor Spicer Rice, PhD. She's a writer, entomologist. Her latest book is Your Pet's Secret Lives, which you've already talked about. But I really wanted to talk about these other two books, too. So we're going to be talking about Unseen Jungle, the microbes that secretly control our world, and Dr. Eleanor's Book of Common Spiders. Eleanor, welcome back.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be back here with y'all.
These two books are great. Now, let's talk about the Unseen Jungle and your other book about the pet's secret lives is definitely part of a series.
Yes.
How did it start?
Well, it started because there were a group of researchers who were working on a National Science Foundation grant, and they were studying these weird little wasps that are too small for you to see and the microbes that they move around with them, and they needed somebody to write about them for children. And
what a weird thing to come up with. Yeah, children need to know about this.
It's the government. They want you to have broader impacts for your research. So a lot of researchers are like, yeah, we can do that. Here, you know, make a puzzle. So they called me and asked me to do it. And I thought it was really boring, but it was during COVID, and I didn't have anything else to do.
Ah, a COVID project. You don't know how many COVID projects I've interviewed the last 2 years.
Yes, I should have learned how to make sourdough bread. But instead, I learned how all these microbes control the minds and bodies of creatures all around us. So I didn't even know what a microbe really was. I had an idea, you know, this general idea, but I didn't really know what a microbe was before I started writing it. And so I had to go all the way back to the beginning. And as I did, I realized that there's all these creatures all around us that have microbial interactions that are pretty wild, including our own selves. And so it changed the way that I see everything. And we just turned all of that research into this book.
It's an amazing book because it's like your other book. There's a lot of technical science information. But it's written really for younger readers. But I have to say, it's also written for older readers, too, because you're too funny.
Well, thanks.
For people who are unprepared, it is sort of weird to realize there are all these other things going on right in front of your face, and you're just not seeing them, including inside.
And on our faces.
On our faces and in our bodies. Now, let's do a definition of what a microbe is, because a microbe isn't one thing.
Oh, no, it's not one thing. It's any living creature that's too small for us to see with the naked eye. So most of us can't see about, if you took a human hair, and you sliced it lengthwise down the middle, and you saw that half of a hair, that is about the smallest thing that you can see without a microscope. That's the outer line. Anything smaller than that is a microbe. So that could be the forehead mites on your face that live, you know, crawl across your face at night mating, or it could be the bacteria, you know, it can be.
Well, let me go down the list and let's just talk about what they are. What are bacteria?
Okay.
Bacteria are single cells?
Bacteria are single celled organisms. Yes. They're just like, you know, eukaryotic single celled organisms and they live everywhere. They cover most surfaces on the planet, including our bodies. If we took them out of our bodies, our bacteria, and our whole microbiome, we would be dead.
Protozoa. Now, I know protozoa. From grade school when I got my first microscope. And I was able
to... Don't these words remind you of grade school?
It
don't
does.
Don't they kind of like wear you out a little bit?
Nah. I mean, paramecium. Yeah, I think I learned the word paramecium when I was 3 or 4. And But
that's a good way to make friends.
And, yeah, right. You hit the nail on the head on that one.
Yeah.
But that's like things like amoebas and so on and so forth, that whole group of life. Now,
right.
I was amazed.
Protozoa can move around.
Mm-hmm. Fungi. Now, there's enough fungi that are microbes that are smaller than you can see?
Yeah, there are plenty of fungi that are microbes that are smaller than you can see. I mean, think about on our bodies, people get yeast infections in their ears and other parts of their bodies. Those yeast or fungi that are living on us and around us. And there are lots of different types of them covering all over the world.
Now, a thing that wasn't there when I was a kid, there wasn't this group, were archaea, A-R-C-H-A-E-A.
Yeah, archaea, right. They're really weird because they are like bacteria, but they're also different from bacteria because they just don't have nuclei. They don't have like a nucleus.
Are they actually alive?
that debatable. But yes, they meet the requirements for being alive. You know what does not meet the requirements for being alive is a virus. So, you know, we still count them as microbes, but a lot of people don't believe that microbes, that viruses are actually living they don't eat.
Yeah, they don't seem to have a lot of the functions that something living would have. They seem more like a biochemical delivery system.
Yeah, that's basically what they are. I mean, they're basically are to be alive. You have to, you know, grow and breathe and reproduce and metabolize and move, respond to the environment, and one more, excrete. But viruses don't do all of those things. They don't eat. They don't excrete. But they do reproduce quite a lot. But we still count them as microbes because some people do, and I counted them because they're really weird. And I like the stories about them.
Now that I've read three books of yours, I totally understand that. Algae. There are microbial algae. So that would be like the pond scum.
Like pond scum. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're just a little type of plant, and they're very small, and they can live in a lot more places than ponds. But algae are just photosynthetic creatures, basically.
Well, that's like archaea. Are those what are called sometimes called extremophiles? That there are certain forms of life that live in geysers or boiling hot springs or like.
Oh yeah. They can live in pretty much anywhere. They love the extreme environment.
And then there's what you call, I love this term, super tiny animals.
Yeah, just super tiny animals, like your forehead mites.
Yeah, right. And there's all, isn't there all?
I don't know
all...
if you've ever like Googled them, but I'm a little bit in love with them. I've started talking to mine because I think they're so cute. They have these like little mustaches and they waddle around on your face and these big fat otter tails.
Aren't there lice that also live on your eyelashes or something like that? Or
lice? Oh,
not lice.
They're eyelash mites.
Mites. Right.
I my children just brought lice home recently. I think I had lice the last time I talked.
It's every parent's nightmare.
Beating faster. Yes. Yeah. But they're gone now. We just chopped off all there. But they're not lice. They're mites that live. And they're great for your body. They're great for your face. They don't, as long as they don't, you know, get overpopulated because your body gets out of whack. But they keep you clean. They eat your oils. They eat your dead skin cells. They're good to have.
A lot of people thinking about things crawling around their face at night, it's probably going to cause so much insomnia.
Yeah, that's true. But don't worry. It's a force of good. In fact, you should just submit yourself to this whole thing of things crawling on you because most conservative estimates are on your human body. For every one human cell, there are three microbe cells. And if you scrape them out of your body and you put them in a sack, it will weigh 6 pounds.
Wow.
So are you microbe or are you man? We don't really know.
You're
your own environment.
We're a habitat then. We have our own.
We're a huge habitat. Yeah, it's called a microbiome.
Yeah.
And you got to have it. You have to have these things. They digest your food. They control the way how attractive you are to other people through the way that you smell. The ones in your stomach produce neurotransmitters, the same neurotransmitters that your brain makes to talk to itself in your body. So they can make you feel depressed or anxious.
Wow.
And they can make you feel happy or calm. And it's all based on what you're feeding them and the way that you're treating them in your body.
What you eat or what you're doing.
Right. Having a healthy microbe or taking, you know, antibiotics can wipe you out.
Oh,
yeah. Depressed after they take antibiotics. And that's because they're wiping out part of their microbiome. And some people find that they get sicker after they take antibiotics, other sicknesses. And that's because they've knocked back the microbes that are helping to keep them safe and well. Your microbes on your skin are your first line of defense against disease. They're covering every spare piece of your skin, and they actively fight off invading creatures. And there are tons of different kinds. In your belly button alone, there are over 100 different species of microbes living inside your belly button. What are they doing? We don't know. They just like that little cave on your belly. That's where they live.
And this is what I love about this book. It takes you where you never thought you'd want to go, like in your belly button. Like the pets book.
Where you are all the time.
Like the pets book, you also have little sections written by other researchers who are specialized in things. For instance, Dr. Hein Minh Tung, who studies microbes in humans, pandas, red pandas, chickens. And you have some of the stuff gets really arcane. Like Erica Vernis Harris, the woman who gave caterpillars a poop transplant.
What a job. Yeah.
She gave it looks good on your resume.
Yeah. It's really neat.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, so what she was doing, so we love Monarch. Everybody knows their Monarch caterpillars, right? And caterpillars are one of the few creatures that don't have a really rich microbiome because they don't need a lot of help digesting stuff. They're just extremely inefficient eaters. They don't sit on it for a long time. It's just in and out, right? And so, I mean, think about the very hungry caterpillar just chomping stuff down all of the time, right? But they also eat milkweed, and there's two types of milkweed. There's the milkweed that can make creatures sick, that the medicinal milkweed, you know, which is why monarchs can survive. You know, creatures don't usually eat monarchs. And then there's non-medicinal milkweed. And Erica found that when monarchs eat that medicinal milkweed, they have more microbes in their gut, and they're more resistant to diseases. So you can take poop from those medicinal milkweed-eating monarchs and give it to the ones that did not eat the medicinal milkweed, and it gives them the powers that the medicinal milkweed has.
Wow.
Because they still have those chemicals in their poop.
That's amazing.
The end. Yeah.
Well,
and microbes. Are, yeah.
And there's so many things like that in this book. There's a thing about termite farts.
Oh, my gosh, termites. Who knew?
Until I read your book.
They produce up to 3% of our annual emissions of methane, which is like this horrible, very, very potent greenhouse gas.
Yeah.
And
I know about the problem they have about cows and their flatulence. But I didn't know termites did that. And there's that many termites in the world.
Oh, the world is covered in termites, and termites are wonderful, wonderful for our environment. We need them. They're only a pest when they get into our homes and things that we want to keep. But if they weren't out in the woods and they weren't under the ground, they aerate the soil, they decompose stuff, and they are very, very tasty. So a lot of creatures like to eat termites, but their microbial system is pretty complex because wood is made out of cellulose, and cellulose is not digestible by pretty much anything except microbes. And even though cellulose is the most abundant organic compound on the planet, right? But most things can't digest it. So termite microbes have stomachs that can turn the dead trees into food, and they have these microbes that have enzymes in it that break down the cellulose into sugar and vinegar. And then inside of those microbes, they have other microbes that break the things down. So they're like a nesting doll of living things. Because you have the termite, and then you have their microbes, and then you have their microbes inside their microbes. And you know where they get their microbes from? This is our word of the day. Are you ready?
Go ahead.
Coprophagy. They eat each other's poop.
Huh.
So little baby termites, when they hatch, they're really cute. They look like little puppies. And the older termites will feed them their poop so that they can inoculate them with their own microbes.
Well, there's all sorts of other things like that in this book. One of the things I learned is that children growing up with pets have a lower incidence of asthma.
Oh, isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
That's from Hein Minh Tung, that researcher you were talking about who studied red pandas. He found that your mama, when you're born, whether you like her or not, whether you've met her or not, she gives you your first dose of microbes. And if she had a dog when she was pregnant with you, whether or not you've ever seen that dog gives her microbes that she gives to you. And for some reason, the microbes that your dog gave your mama, who gave it to you, are associated with people who have those in their body have lower incidence of childhood obesity and asthma. We don't know why yet, that, so the world is still has so many possibilities for understanding, but there is a strong correlation between these dog microbes and these children's health and well-being.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Eleanor Spicer Rice, PhD. She's a writer, entomologist. Her latest book is Your Pet's Secret Lives. But tonight we're talking about other books that she's written, including we've been focusing on Unseen Jungle, the microbes that secretly control our world. Some of the people that are included in this book are just sort of really interesting. Is it Nakiata McCallum, who loves Escherichia coli?
Oh, yeah. She loves E. coli. She works for the
FDA. That's a tough love for me. It's like, I really have to warm up to E. coli.
Oh, you might as well. You know what? It's one of those things that you can love at a distance. You can just love it. You can admire it, maybe. So, I mean, love might be a strong word. But she's really great. She works. We have people in the United States, and their job is to test food randomly to see if it's safe. And she's one of those people who does that. Nicola is like her favorite to find because that's like the jackpot, right? That's the one that shuts everything down. So that's what she does. She goes and she tests our food for us. And she's wonderful, and she loves the work that she does, and she's fascinated by it, which is great, because it doesn't sound like my dream job.
No. But on the E. coli tip, you also have Rob Wilson's, who's the illustrator of your books, How to Draw the Microbe E. coli Enjoying a Hot Dog.
Isn't that useful in your life? Hot dogs, which often have E. coli. A little bit of a brain bender. Yeah. One something I really like about these books is that if I write something down, Rob has to draw it.
That's right.
So I try to pick things, and he gets easily grossed out by things. So I try to find things that deliberately that freak him out and see what happens. And it's wonderful to me to see what he figures out.
Do you have one of the books handy?
No, but I can go get one.
Okay.
I can get the e-version.
Because I wanted to ask you about the bed bug limericks that you wrote. First of all, when I first came across your...
I can't believe they put... How did they leave those in is my question.
Yeah. But I thought, okay, there's one limerick about a...
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's horrible.
But there's almost a collection of bed bug limericks.
Yeah. Well, we sit around, my children and I sit around and write limericks about children that bother them.
Yeah.
And so that's limericks about things. I'm going down. I have an e-copy of it now, so I can go up and find them. So writing limericks is a thing that we do. Do you want to hear the one about Grace who killed her killed her fish?
Yeah.
Okay. This is written by a six-year-old. There once was a girl named Grace who farted her way into space. With her butt as a rocket and nothing to stop it, she never came back to this place. Poor Grace. So these are ones about bed bugs. I'm here now.
Okay.
You know, Love Wax was actually supposed to be Climax on that one.
Okay.
But I'm here. I'm here to watch. But Climax apparently was too hard for, that was not allowed for children.
Okay.
I'm ready.
Okay, go.
Which one do you want me to do?
Do your first one.
Okay. There once was a bed bug named Cymex. She didn't want roses or lilacs. If she found a good mate, she'd get stabbed on her date, and her microbe would change from her love's wax, which was supposed to be Climax.
And that Climax makes more sense, by the way.
It really does make a lot more sense. Love wax is actually, to me, is a little bit grosser than So what happens with bed bugs is when they mate, they don't mate like people do. The male just has this very stabby needle, and he just stabs her anywhere in her stomach. And that's how you can tell if a female bed bug is a virgin or not. She will have scars, mating scars.
Whoa.
I have no idea how that had to do with microbes. I cannot remember what that had to do with.
Well, there's microbes in the bed bugs. That's why.
Yeah, but that doesn't have to do with their mating. I think that was just an aside, maybe.
We're going to run out of time here, but I want to mention the other book, Dr. Eleanor's Book of Common Spiders, that you wrote with Christopher M. Buttle. Now, and it's a totally different kind of text, because I actually consider this a serious field guide to spiders, like some people's first field guide to spiders. Is that why you wrote it?
I did. I wrote it because I wrote a series of these about ants. And Chris is a fantastic arachnologist at McGill University. And he wanted us to write one about spiders. So he helped me. One thing we found out was it's the Book of Common Spiders. We didn't know what the most common spiders are in anywhere.
Right.
Nobody knows. So we had to crowdsource information about what people were finding, what other arachnologists and other entomologists were finding most common in their areas. And that's how we found out what we think are the most common spiders, but we really don't know as much about spiders in this world as we'd like.
You really hit probably the top species. I think you really succeeded. And it's really interesting. It's a small book, and it's just a really interesting book to have in your house. Before we go, I want to say I had a great experience with bowl and doily spiders. I was hiking in this area, and there was a big sort of open field in the forest, and there must have been 1,000 bowl and doily spider webs. I'd never seen anything like that. And they look so weird because it's literally, it looks like there's a bowl made out of web, and underneath it, like something that it would be sitting on. And I've never seen so many of them before or since. And it was just an incredible moment of seeing these. And they were all glistening because it was morning dew kind of a thing. It was amazing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that sounds so dreamy because it's such an intricate. I mean, can you imagine?
I know.
If you think about the way spider webs, all the different types of spider webs, you can learn so much about a spider just seeing how it builds its web. And that's something I didn't think about before this book. You've got sheet webs, you've got cobwebs, and they work in their own ways. And the bowl and doily is just so beautiful. They just kind of get banged around in that top weird part, and they get stuck on that bottom, and then the spider comes out and eats them. And when she mates, her mate moves in with her and eats all her food, by the way. Because it's not easy to build a bowl and doily.
It's not. Now, another group of spiders that I dearly love are the huge fishing spiders.
Oh, my gosh. They freak me out.
Well, they're big, and they carry the young on their abdomen for a while.
Oh, it's beautiful.
And then they build like a little thing for they carry the eggs, and then the eggs hatch in a nursery web. And they actually guard the nursery web. There's actually parental behavior.
Yes, they have. They're really great. They're great parents, and they have a really great success in terms of, like, you know, one of the reasons insects and spiders make so many offspring is because young insects and spiders are food for everything. But fishing spiders have one of the highest success rates as parents. They protect them so well, and they can run on water too.
Yeah,
which is pretty amazing.
Well, they can.
They've got hydrophobic hairs.
They can catch fish in tadpoles.
Yes, they can catch. They're ferocious. I would never grab one because they can bite. They're some of the ones that bite, but they don't bite unless they have to, you know? And they also, something that's strange, and I don't know how it works, they come in different colors.
Yeah.
I mean, and they can match their bodies to the environment. So they somehow know, you know, and I don't know how this works, but a fishing spider who looks like an oak tree can match it, can stand on an oak tree and sit there. A fishing spider that looks like the side of your pier can stand on the side of your pier and hide, which is pretty amazing to me. And crab spiders can actually change their color to match their
crab spiders are amazing. I was doing a bird survey once, and we had to stay in one place for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a thing of goldenrod in front of us. And I started picking out the crab spiders that were living there and preying on all the different insects that would visit the goldenrod. It was amazing.
And they're ambush. Practice.
Yeah, they are.
See them on the flower heads.
Yep. Yeah.
And something that's neat about them, can I tell you like a real weird thing about their mating?
We're almost out of time. Go ahead.
Okay, we'll talk about spider sex some other time.
Okay. Okay, because I wanted to talk about my favorite Argiops, the big, beautiful webs that you see in the fields. We have too much to talk about. We didn't even finish talking about the microbe book. My returning guest tonight is Eleanor Spicer Rice, PhD. She's a writer and entomologist. Her latest book is Your Pet's Secret Lives, which I strongly recommend. But this show, we've been talking about Unseen Jungle. the microbes that secretly control our world, and Dr. Eleanor's Book of Common Spiders, which is a wonderful guide to have in your house. Eleanor, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I'm so grateful for it.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.